As you know, I love Spurgeon, and one of the things about Spurgeon's testimony has always intrigued me. He used to speak of himself as someone who had been kept a long time by God before he came to faith. And if you know his testimony, you know that he came to faith as a teenager. But he spent 5 years under conviction before he finally came to faith, and it seemed like an eternity to him before the Lord saved him. And my testimony is a bit that way. I was saved at age 17, a month before I graduated from high school. And yet I still sometimes feel like I was saved late in life, and I still feel like, now I'm age 65, but I feel like still a new Christian. And I have to remind myself sometimes, I'm not a new Christian anymore. And here's how it came about. I grew up in a Methodist church, and in the days when the United Methodist Church was already hopelessly liberal, and went to Sunday school every week with my parents. They were faithful to take me to church. They just didn't have the discernment to know that this church had gone bad. And in the Sunday school classes, we were being taught not to believe the Bible. And I mean that literally. Every single week, our Sunday school teacher, who was a woman who had a PhD in philosophy or something and considered herself a very intelligent person, she would deal with and at least she'd open the Bible and get into it, but she'd read a story from the New Testament and then tell us, you shouldn't take this literally. This didn't really happen. I remember most vividly the week she covered the man with the withered hand. And she said, of course, this isn't a real story. This didn't actually happen. It's like a moral fable, she said. And I didn't understand the moral lesson of it or any of that. It just irked me that I realized for 2 years I'd been listening to this woman tell us why you shouldn't believe the Bible. And honestly, I didn't do this to be a smart aleck. I did it because it was a legitimate question. And I asked her, if we don't believe the Bible and we're not supposed to take it seriously, why do we come and talk about it every week? Because I'd rather be at home watching the pregame show for football. Made sense to me. And she told the pastor of that church that I had smarted off like that. And he summoned me to his office on a Tuesday afternoon. And I went to his office, and I assumed he believed the Bible. And I thought, you know, if I tell on this woman what she's been telling us, maybe he'll fire her as our Sunday school teacher. But I told him what she'd been saying, and his response was, she's right, you know. And he said, you don't really believe that all those things happened. You don't believe Jonah got swallowed by a fish. You don't believe Moses parted the Red Sea. You don't believe that Elisha made an axe head float. You don't believe things like that because they don't happen. And at first I said, well, but that's what makes them miracles, right? And he says, but miracles aren't real. They're lessons, moral lessons. And he said, take the man from the withered hand. He said, here's what that moral lesson was. The guy had heard Jesus teach, if your right hand offends you, cut it off. And so he had bound up his hand and resolved not to use it. And because he knew Jesus wasn't speaking literally, he didn't need to cut off his hand, so he just bound it up. And Jesus forgave him his sins and told him, you can loose your hand and let it go. And that's how he healed the guy with the withered hand. And in my 17-year-old mind, I thought, that kind of makes sense. And so he went through 3 or 4 miracles like that and explained them away. And I left his office that day thinking, okay, I can stay home and watch the NFL pregame show. And I didn't go back to that church because, not because I was angry with him, but because I thought, okay, nobody really believes this. And although on the way home, I'm driving in the car and I remember, so I must have been about 16 years old because I was driving by then. And I remember thinking as I stopped at a stoplight, I asked him about all the miracles I knew, and there weren't many because I didn't know the Bible very well. But on the way home, I thought, I wish I had asked him about the resurrection of Christ, because I knew in my heart that he didn't believe in the resurrection either, because that's like all those other miracles. Stuff like that doesn't happen. That's what he would have said. But I also knew that if he admitted to the people in that church that he didn't believe Christ really rose from the dead, that would be the death of that church, and that he was being dishonest. So I stopped going to church and for a while didn't even feel any pangs of conscience about it. But after a year and a half or 2 years, I began to sense this void in my life. And a friend of mine who'd never even gone to church, as far as I knew, he had no
religious leanings whatsoever. He was saved during an Easter retreat that year. And the change in his life was so remarkable that within 3 weeks I thought, okay, whatever happened to him really changed him. It really did. And it made me begin to think, I hope I haven't given up on Christianity too quickly. I was into politics. I loved politics. My goal, my life goal, was to be a newspaper columnist like William F. Buckley. He was my model. And I was a conservative, which wasn't popular in those days. You know, all the students I went to school with were hippies. But I was a conservative, and I wanted to write newspaper articles that would just rub people the wrong way. That's what I thought would be a great job for me. I do it on my blog now sometimes. But anyway, all that aside, I thought, if there is a God, and I really believe there was, so it wasn't in my mind thinking, if there is a God. I thought, okay, God, whoever he is, must really like, he must want us to improve ourselves and improve our world and be knowledgeable, gain knowledge, gain understanding. And so I stopped listening to rock music, began to listen to classical music, and began to study philosophy and things that I thought would, you know, make me a better person. The wisdom of this world, basically. Politics, mainly. And because I thought if there's a way to change the world for the better, the vehicle must be politics. And yet it left me with this great emptiness. And when my friend was converted suddenly, the change in his life was dramatic. And he's not into politics. He's not into classical music. He's not into any of the things that I thought, if I did, would please God. And yet, clearly, he loved the Lord, and that's all he ever talked about, and the change in his life was just remarkable. And so one evening, I was having trouble getting to sleep. I'm lying in my bed. It's probably about 10:30 at night, and I had school the next day, and so I needed to go to sleep. But I couldn't sleep, and my conscience was bothering me. I had said something unkind to my sister just before she went to bed, so she went to bed mad at me. And I was just feeling like a real dirtbag. And so I thought, I need to do something religious. You know, I need to do something spiritual to make myself at least feel better. And so I had a Bible. I picked it up. It was one of those with the zipper closure. I kept it zipped so it would stay in mint condition. I'd never read a chapter of it. I had never, if I used it at all, it was to flop it open at random. And whatever page it lit on, I would single out a verse and read it like the horoscope, as if this verse must have some significance to me, like a very superstitious approach. So that's all I knew to do. And so I thought, okay, I'm gonna do that tonight. And I flopped open my Bible, and it opened to the first page of Paul's epistle to the First Corinthians. And I thought, I think in retrospect, that is not where you'd send a 17-year-old high school kid troubled in conscience to find the gospel, right? It's not where you'd send him. But I thought, okay, I was only going to read a couple of verses, but it opened to the first page. I'd never read a whole book of the Bible. If I did that, that would really earn me some merit. That's what I was thinking. And so I counted the pages, and I thought, okay, it's a bigger book than I hoped. But I'm going to try to read the whole thing anyway. And so I began to read, and almost from the beginning, everything Paul writes there rebuked me. Because that's all about, he says to the Corinthians, when I came to you, I did not come with words of human wisdom and eloquent speech and all that, but I just came preaching Christ and him crucified. And the more I read, the more I thought, well, it's like God doesn't like the wisdom of this world. The very thing that I thought he must want me to cultivate. And when I got to 1 Corinthians 3:18, just three chapters in, it says, let me read it to you. First Corinthians 3:18, and I was reading from the King James, so that's what I'll read. Let no man deceive himself. If any man among you seemeth to be wise in this world, let him become a fool that he may be wise. For the wisdom of this world is foolishness with God. For it is written, he taketh the wise in their own craftiness. And again, the Lord knows the thoughts of the wise, that they are vain. Therefore, let no man glory in men. And when I finished just that much, I thought, well, that just condemns me. It's the very thing I thought God would would be pleased with, he says he hates. Why does he hate the wisdom of this world? Because I could understand perfectly if the Lord said he hated the foolishness of this world. I hate the foolishness of this world too. Why doesn't God hate that more than he hates the wisdom of this world? And I realize it's because he doesn't want us to glory in men. He doesn't want us to boast. And by the time I got out of chapter 3, I was feeling very lost, totally convicted that if I died right now, I'd go to hell. But I kept reading, and again, 1 Corinthians is not the easiest book to understand until I got to 1 Corinthians chapter 12. And I couldn't understand this at all because I didn't know the context of, you know, the charismatic gifts and all of that. I wasn't even reading it in that light. But here Paul says, let me find the verse. Verse 3, wherefore I give you to understand that no man speaking by the Spirit of God calls Jesus accursed, and no man can say that Jesus is Lord except by the Holy Spirit. Now, I didn't know what that meant. I mean, in context, I didn't know what it meant, but I understood it clearly enough to know that Christ demands to be, he is Lord, and he demands to be recognized as Lord, and without the Holy Spirit, you cannot recognize him as Lord. And so I prayed that he would reveal himself to me as Lord. And he did. An amazing series of things happened that very week. In fact, because I was reading the King James Version, I thought, I need a modern translation of the Bible that I can understand. So the very next day, I went to the bookshop to get a modern translation, not knowing even which one to pick out. But the amazing thing was, as I was walking through the shopping mall, there was a guy passing out these little leaflets. And they were gospel tracts. Nobody had ever given me a gospel tract. And he gave me a gospel tract that explained the doctrine of justification. I took it home and read it and felt like I had a new understanding of the gospel. And that very night, I get an unexpected phone call from a guy who was a friendly acquaintance of mine, but I wouldn't have called him a friend. He just was a guy I knew. We played in an orchestra together. And he said, he's stumbling around. I can tell he's about to say something he doesn't want to say to me. And he says, Phil, I go to this church, and he says, we're helping to sponsor an evangelistic crusade here in Tulsa this week. And I'm required. I made a commitment to ask a friend to attend with me. And he said, I thought of you. And I knew immediately he thought of me because he figured I was a friend he could afford to lose, right? But it was okay. I said, no, I'm really glad you asked. I'd love to go with you. Because I'm trying to understand the gospel, you know. And we went that night, and I will never forget the message the man preached. It was on the crucifixion of Christ. And he started in Isaiah 53. And despite my background in Sunday school, I had no idea that the crucifixion of Christ was in the Old Testament. But he explained the atonement and the way of salvation. And by the end of that week, I was soundly converted. I can't tell you which hour I passed from death unto life. But it was a week of progression where I went from utter unbelief and ignorance to where I truly understood the gospel. And I only have 10 minutes. I've probably used all of it already. But I'll make this story very short. I didn't even know where to go to church after that. So I just began to visit churches in my neighborhood. And in Tulsa, that's either liberal Southern Baptist churches or rank charismatic churches. Of course, Tulsa is the home of Oral Roberts University and Kenneth Hagin's headquarters are there. Kenneth Copeland was trained there. T.L. Osborne had his headquarters. Every major charismatic at that time had some tie to Tulsa. And in fact, my best friend was the son of a charismatic faith healer. And he'd never given me the gospel. He'd talked to me about speaking in tongues, but he had never given me the gospel. And so I knew enough from that to know that he's not giving me the gospel. I'm not going to a charismatic church and hear about speaking in tongues. I want to hear the gospel. And so I tried two or three churches at random and ended up in a fundamentalist Baptist church where it was very fundamentalist, but at least the guy preached the gospel. And he saw me the morning I visited. I came in a suit and tie, and which is also unusual for a high school kid and for anybody in a church in Tulsa, actually. So I kind of stuck out like a sore thumb, and he could tell I was a visitor. And it was one of those churches that didn't have a center aisle. It had two aisles. And he went to that aisle to greet guests as they left. And so I tried to dart out that aisle because I didn't really want to talk to anybody. I was just visiting, just shopping around. And he intercepted me. He crossed over there and he said, "What brings you here?" And I said, "I'm a new Christian. I'm looking for a church to attend." He said, "Well, you found the right one." He said, "Are you baptized?" He's a Baptist, right? Fundamentalist Baptist. And I said, "No." And well, I said, "I was baptized as an infant in the Methodist church." He says, "That's not good enough. You need to be baptized as a believer." And he says, "If you come tonight, we've got a baptismal service. I'll baptize you." And so I said, "Okay." You know, I thought, "Well, all right, if I need to get baptized, I'm going to do it." And I went an hour early so I could give him my full testimony and he could, you know, make sure I was truly converted. And he said to me then, "What are you going to do with your life? What do you want to do?" I said, "You know, I always wanted to be a newspaper columnist, but I don't want to do that now. Because it's the wisdom of this world and it's foolishness with God. I just want to serve the Lord." He said, "You need to go to Bible college." And I said, "I don't even know where to start." And so he named about six, you know, fundamentalist schools. And Moody Bible Institute was the last one on the list. It's the only one on the list I'd ever heard of because they sponsored some stuff that I had seen. And I said, "Is that a good school?" And he said, "Well, that's where I graduated from." And I said, "Okay, that's where I'm going to go." And that's how I made that decision. It wasn't a thoughtful decision, but it turned out to be a good one because at least at Moody, while I wouldn't endorse all of their theology, even in the days I was there, that at least they taught us the Bible. I did learn the Bible. And I also hung on after graduation and stayed working at Moody Press, which became the publisher of John MacArthur, which is how I got in touch with John MacArthur. And he wanted me to be his editor. So he brought me to Grace Church. And from there, actually, I was at Grace Church for 11 years before I ever spoke in public to adults, a group larger than my own living room. I taught a living room Bible study. It was Lance Quinn, your friend, who goaded me into preaching. And so that's how I got into ministry. That's the short story. There is a much longer one, but I won't keep taking time.
Anything else about the present ministry with John MacArthur? I know a lot of people like to know a little more detail about your involvement with MacArthur all these years.
Yeah, you know, I've been working with John MacArthur since 1981, and I've been at Grace Church since 1983, so 35 years. I'm about to celebrate my 36th anniversary there. And like my salvation, it still feels new. I love it. I've never regretted a moment of going there. I've learned most of what I know from John MacArthur's preaching. And it's been my privilege to edit his material for print, for book form. And from that, everything else, just sort of the training I received was more or less by osmosis. I've never been to seminary. When I went to Grace Church, I thought, "Oh, good, I'll be able to enroll in the seminary there." But I just never had the time. And so I have never sat in 1 hour of seminary class as a student. And so I backed into ministry, is how I'd say it.
One final thing. Can you tell us who you followed at Grace to your job?
You mean whose job I took?
Yeah.
A guy named Hal Hayes.
Who was the person you followed? I remember it was a woman.
Oh, well, sure. Your wife. Actually, though, I didn't take her job. I want that clear. The week I started to work at Grace to You, Dawn Johnson was her name at the time. And she was in the room across the hall, directly across the hall from me. And while I was being introduced as the new guy to all the other employees, she said to me, "Yeah, this is my last week. I'm leaving at the end of the week." I said, "Well, I hope it's not because I came." And she said, "No, it's because I'm going to marry Jerry Marcellino." And I said, "Well, good for you." So Dawn and I were fellow employees for exactly 1 week. And then she left. And she was one of the study guide editors there. She edited study guides for John MacArthur, which I never did, actually. I edited the other books. So she can have her job back anytime she wants.